BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to Dalek Radio. Good evening. I'm proud to announce that this programme is sponsored by The Converging World. The Converging World is an organisation that aims to create a world where everyone has equal access to resources whilst minimising their impact on the planet. If you want to find out more, have a look at theconvergingworld.org. On today's show, all the usual favourites. This week, Tony Gosling reads his fourth part of The History of the Theatre in Bristol, and Lisa Braden reports back from having seen the play American Clock. Matt Heap has some interviews fresh from the Refugee Week, and Anthea Page reports from Marrakesh. Malcolm Grieve reads from Cider with Rosie, and throughout, some tasty musical selections designed to raise your spirits. We have The Specials, The Freestylers, The Dub Pistols, and The Incredible Shoe Band. But first, time for a news item from Tony Gosling. Human rights lawyer Clive Stafford Smith has accused the US military of detaining Sudanese journalist Sami Al-Haj in Guantanamo Bay because he'd trained with the Al Jazeera news agency. The precise words were, the detainee admitted that he had trained in the use of the camera with Al Jazeera, and that is meant to be understood as some sort of terrorism, he said in an interview with Reporters Without Borders. There was no legal basis to the detention of Sami Al-Haj, who was released in May. He charged, they would come up with new allegations and we would prove the allegations were rubbish. Sami arrived at hospital in Khartoum, Sudan after his release, following a 20-hour flight in which he was not allowed to use the toilet and was shackled and hooded. Clive Stafford Smith said that as well as being tortured during his captivity, Sami had been told by US doctors that he had cancer, but that he could not see a specialist. Sudanese doctors said afterwards he tested negative for cancer. The US authorities deny the charge of torture, but the lawyer said Sami spent a total of 478 days altogether on a hunger strike, and that guards pulled the tube inserted through the nose of hunger strikers explicitly to try and press prisoners to come off hunger strike. He said, Guantanamo Bay is going to close, but the real issue is that the US has about 27,000 prisoners in other secret jails, where prisoners are in worse conditions than those in Guantanamo. And now in a topical light and something slightly lighter, it's time for Matt's Muses.
The 41st World Custard Pie Throwing Championships have been held in Kent. Competitors in Maidstone were given points for hitting each other over the head with out-of-date pies. Shots to the head got the best scores. The National Skipping and Kent Welly Throwing Championships were also held on the same day. The events received news and TV coverage from as far away as Japan, China and the US. In the US, the Mayor of New York, Michael Bloomberg, announced a new scheme to make parts of Manhattan traffic-free. The scheme is called Summer Streets and will run on three consecutive Saturdays in August. A seven-mile route will be closed to traffic, bikes will be made available to rent, and they are going to run exercise classes such as yoga and dance sessions. In the end, Summer Streets is an experiment, said Mr. Bloomberg. We have never been afraid to try new ideas out, especially ones that have the potential to improve our quality of life. In Romania, quite a different kind of mayor has been causing an uproar by getting more votes than his rival, despite being dead. The mayor is reported to have died from liver disease. Liver disease is not something that has ever affected Mr. Harry Patch, who recently celebrated his 110th birthday. Mr. Patch fought in the Battle of Passchendaele and is the second oldest UK survivor from World War I. The oldest is Henry Ellington, who is 112 years old. After the war, Mr. Patch played a key part in the construction of the World's Memorial Building, which is the cornerstone of Bristol University. World War I was fought against the Germans. Germany's football coach Joachim Löw has been banned from the touchline for his team's next game in the quarterfinals of Euro 2008. I have no idea why. If you know, please tell me. On the subject of football, if you were to ask most people which country is the greatest footballing nation, they would probably argue Brazil. Brazil has the largest concentration of people of Japanese descent, apart from Japan itself. Japan is near Korea and China, where it has been reported that people are proud at being good at maths, because they know the future of their economies depend on it. This is in stark contrast to Britain, where it is cool not to be good at maths. We have our priorities right. Let's not forget the custard pie throwing, skipping and welly throwing.
Thank you very much, Matt. And now let's have a bit of the Freestylers, and this is Weekend Song. Welcome back, and now something for your belly. The Wine and Cheese Food Fair is on here in Bristol in July. Our intrepid reporter came across some more unusual items on the menu in Gemma El Fna, excuse my pronunciation, the main square in Marrakesh, which has a link with, well, Weymouth, actually.
Habibi, Habibi, the Hibbag, Habibi.
This is bloody marvelous.
What is it?
Well, we have sausages, shish kebab, tajik, couscous, fish, rajif, salad, pastilla, chicken, roasted chicken, prawns, calamari, kungur, sardine, potato cake, ikbal, pepper, chips and chips.
Are you selling chips head tonight?
Chips head? You want chips head?
No, how much is it?
It depends. it depends on the volume of the sheep. If you want sheep, have sheep, or just a small small thing.
And do you eat everything?
Yeah, yeah, we have everything. Bloody marvelous. Hell's kitchen.
No, but do you eat the whole head?
They eat the whole head. The brain, the lung, the tongue.
The eyes?
The eyes, no. But some people have kind of culture. They eat the eyes to push the bad eyes from them.
Oh.
Just kind of culture.
Oh.
Yeah. Where are you from?
England.
I'm from Dorset.
Yeah.
Weymouth.
Have you ever eaten a sheep's eye?
Sheep?
Have you ever eaten the eye of a sheep?
No, never. Oh. I never had it. But some people, kind of culture, such kind of culture.
But you've eaten a sheep's head?
I eat sheep's head. It's very delicious. You don't like it? Why?
Have you eaten a camel's head?
Camel's head, it doesn't exist here.
Oh,
no longer.
Seen it in
it's in the new city, or in the outskirts,
Meknes.
Or in the desert.
Yeah, Meknes we've seen.
Yeah. But here, because it's very expensive, and people, it's really, you find people asking for it.
Oh, right.
But it's good to eat it.
Okay.
So, let's be having you. I'm Helsinki Masters. 117 takes you to heaven.
Lovely job.
Bloody marvelous. Air conditioner, swimming pool and the roof. Lovely javelin. Thomas Hardy, the mayor of Casterbridge, far from Madding Crowd.
Oh,
this is
so
far from Madding Crowd.
Oh,
and D.H. Lawrence, Rainbow, Sons and Lovers.
Oh.
Jane Austen, Pride and Prejudice. Joseph Conrad, Henry James, Harold Pinter, Hemingway, Bernard Shaw, Oscar Wilde, Charles Dickens, Thomas Jefferson, Edgar Allan Poe, Steinbeck.
Have you read all that?
I got my degree in English literature, specialized in linguistics.
Where?
In Marrakesh, here, in university.
Oh.
Nice to meet you.
Yeah.
Have a good time.
Okay, thank you.
Bloody marvelous. 117. Next to heaven. Lovely jubbly.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Refugee Week is a UK-wide programme of arts, cultural and educational events that celebrate the contribution of refugees to the UK and encourages a better understanding between communities. This year's event started early. There was a range of activities from the 12th to the 22nd of June, so that included music, dance, film, football, visual arts, poetry, debate and discussion events. And they were planned for the week, offering an opportunity for everyone to come together at different locations around the city. Matt Heap, who's recently joined our team, joined them in Queen Square on Sunday the 15th and managed to chat to some interested characters about why this cause matters to them and why their cause should matter to us.
Hi, I'm with a lady called Claire. Hi, Claire.
Hello.
And so we're here at the part of Refugee Week. It's an event being held at Queen Square. I wonder, Claire, if you can tell me a little bit about your organisation, what it's called, what it does, that kind of thing.
Okay, I work for Refugee Action. We're a national charity. We've been going about 26 years in the UK. And for the most part, we provide support to newly arrived asylum seekers around their entitlements, access to education, access to any kind of support that they might need. And then we also work with refugees, so once people have refugee status, to help them build new lives in the UK in any way that they want to. I personally run a project called the Refugee Awareness Project, which is all about going out and talking to the community and raising awareness about who refugees are, who asylum seekers are, and how the local community can support people. And we have a team of volunteers, half of whom are refugees themselves, and we go out and do interactive workshops, we come and do display stands, we put on theatre presentations, that kind of thing.
So the organisation's been running for 26 years. How long have you been working for the organisation?
I've been working here for 3 years, since the start of the Refugee Awareness Project.
And what would you say the challenges have been in the last 3 years? Have those challenges changed at all? What are the main things you're up against here?
One of the biggest things for us as an organisation is how refused asylum seekers are treated. So when someone's been through the asylum process and their claim has not been successful, there's two issues. There's one about what happens to those people. All of their support is cut off. and many of them are unable to return. And people can be unable to return for many reasons. One could be that there's no actual safe route of return to their country, so you can fly into Iraq for a very long time, for example. That someone doesn't have travel documents and they need travel documents to travel. That the country where they are from won't accept them back. And then there's a whole other set of people who feel, and quite rightly so, that their asylum claim has not been fairly heard. So they were unable to access legal aid. They had an interpreter that spoke the incorrect dialect to that which they spoke. They weren't able to gather evidence in time for their hearing. And those people feel that the reasons they came in the first place haven't changed and they can't return home. But their support is cut off and they're left destitute. So for us, one of the most important things is to have a more humane and effective asylum system that looks after people from the start of their asylum claim to the end. And the end means to resolving how they're going to return home in a dignified manner and making sure that the system has been fair and effective throughout.
Do you think the system has become more friendly to immigrants or less friendly to immigrants in the last 3 years?
I can only talk about asylum seekers and refugees and not general immigration policy. But there has been a trend in the UK towards a stricter asylum policy. I would say there's been a trend towards stricter asylum policy. For example, the introduction of laws around making it a criminal offence to destroy travel documents is one example. Things around how quickly people claim asylum, things around people's support being cut off if they don't report to the police station on a given day. More and more things have been added to the asylum system to make it a more draconian system.
Yeah. If not this country, then what countries are fairly friendly to asylum seekers, if not this country?
I think this country is friendly. The people are friendly. If you go out and talk to people about who asylum seekers are and why they've come to this country to seek protection and what they're fleeing from, the British public are fantastic. The problem is that the majority of the sources of information on the subject are the media, and the media confuses a lot of the issues around asylum and mixes it up with general immigration and often focuses on negative stories rather than positive stories. So I do think this country is welcoming if people are given the opportunity, and I think the government is responding very similarly to all European countries on asylum policy. What's interesting is the country that hosts the most refugees in the world would be Iran, and that's one of the less developed countries in the world, yet they host 13% of the world's refugees. So I think we could be doing more, and we could be doing more to look after the people who do make it all the way here. We only look after 3% of the world's refugees.
For those people listening at home, is there any contact numbers or websites that you'd like to give out now for people who want to find out more?
Yes, you could look at our website, which is www.refugee-action.org.uk, and you can be guided to local organisations nearer your area, as well as actions that you can take to support refugees in your area.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Claire, and thank you much for your time.
We now return to Bristol Refugee Week for the second of our interviews as Matt Heap talks to the Bristol Zimbabwe Association.
Well, I'm here now with a lady called
Agnes Chapisa
and a gentleman called
Henry Muciani.
And these guys are from an organisation called
The Bristol Zimbabwe Association.
Okay, so the Bristol Zimbabwe Association. We're here at Queen Square for as part of Refugee Week. Could I ask you what your main goals are as your organisation?
As an organisation, I mean, it's a group that was formed by Zimbabweans to support each other here in the UK and in Bristol particularly. And we also fundraise for some orphanage in Zimbabwe. So that's what the organisation has been set for.
Are there many Zimbabweans in Bristol? Is there a big community here?
Yeah, it's a very big community, really. I mean, we're talking in excess of 1,000 people. Yes, some have come in here as refugees, and some as immigrant workers, especially in the health field. There are doctors, there are nurses, pharmacists, and all the like, who are employed by the British White Hospitals here.
The situation in Zimbabwe is not good at the moment. What do you anticipate will happen in the future, or is that almost impossible to say?
Oh, well, I mean, when it started, in 2000, we thought maybe by the end of 2000 it would be over. But it has gone on till 2008. So really, the future is bleak. We can't tell what is going to happen. But what is clear is that the people are voting against the present-day government, and hopefully by the 27th of June, we might have a new government.
Do you think the international community could have done more, could be doing more to help the situation?
Yes, they could have done more, but as usual, people are each country selfishly responds to issues in another country because of personal what interest. We don't have any oil in Zimbabwe, therefore there's no interest whatsoever in the country. In the 60s, obviously there was a lot of interest in gold and other minerals. There was quite a lot of interest about Zimbabwe, but because gold is no longer very important, and therefore they are not interested in the country. They're not interested in what happened to the Zimbabweans.
So the government perhaps hasn't done all it could. What's your feeling about the local people of Bristol, their response to days like today? Do you feel optimistic from having spoken to the people of Bristol on events like today?
Well, in terms of, people are here. They are celebrating Refugee Week, and this is a very good reminder about what is happening all over the world, because it's not only Zimbabweans, refugees that are present today. We've got people from Somalia, we've got people from the Asian continent and so forth. That actually shows what the kind of calamities that are all over the world that are causing the people to migrate or to leave their countries and seek refuge elsewhere.
Thank you very much. I wish you the best of luck.
Thank you.
Cheers.
Thank you.
Thank you very much to Henry and Agnes from the Bristol Zimbabwe Association for that interview. Now it's time to hear a tune by the Dub Pistols.
What you trying to tell me, Paul? What? 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 From just a spark in the dark, the shine from sight beyond light illuminates the rhymes that I write, the manuscripts I handle, energize like solar panels, hip-hop vandal, keep me moving through the channels, be my name, claim my fame, from place to place we rock, leaving witnesses in shock, we can't stop, it's the D-U-B, P-I-S-T-O-L-S, coming fresh with the low-tech around my neck, smoke a branch with the licks, whatever it takes to get vigorous with this, we insist, move around, get wild, and bug out, always going new spots, taking different routes. You can't top this, the altitude at which we drop this. Got pilots coming out the cockpit to cop this in my tent. We at it again, Jimmy Fly, Snook Attackers, and we got you all pinned. You can't top this, the altitude at which we drop this. Got pilots coming out the cockpit to cop this in my tent. Yeah, yo, we at it again, Jimmy Fly, Snook
quick attack, saying we got you all pinned. Then again, you might think you got it. Up in the corner like a boxer, trying to make a profit. When you just a product, a figment of the mind, remember it's mine. You just a link in the assembly line. Put it together on the 9-to-5 grind. After that, head home, take a bubble bath, try and relax. It ain't worth it. You know where the trouble be at. Thinking you're perfect, saving for the birds. I know what I heard. Action gotta follow through on them words. Got me losing my nerve. Driving through it when my vision is blurred. Hitting curves while my man hits the. Trying to merge, but your style is absurd. It needs work.
Can't top this. The altitude at which we drop this. Got pilots coming out the cockpit. The cowboys in Mach 10.
We at it again. Jimmy Fly, Snook Attack, and we got you all pinned.
You can't top this. The altitude at which we drop this. Got pilots coming out the cockpit. The cowboys in Mach 10.
Yeah, yo, we at it again. Jimmy Fly, Snook Attack, and we got you all pinned.
Welcome back. That was Mach 10 by the Dub Pistols. And here's Matt Heap once again with the third of his interviews for Bristol Refugee Week. And this time he's talking to Tej, a volunteer for Survival International.
Well, welcome back to Queen Square on this fairly sunny Sunday afternoon, part of Refugee Week. And I'm talking to a gentleman called
Tej.
Tej. Good afternoon, Tej.
Hello.
Could you tell me a bit about the organisation you represent and what you do?
We're basically a group of volunteers who are running a stall here and a film tent for Survival International. Survival International is a human rights organisation working, much like Amnesty, working specifically with tribal and indigenous peoples. So as well as human rights, it's land rights, which is absolutely fundamental to their way of life and their livelihood.
That's quite a big brief, I suppose. Do you focus on any particular areas in the world, or is it really any at all?
It's pretty much global. So we're talking about tribes, people from Siberia, Amazon, Africa, Indonesia, Malaysia. It's really very much a grassroots. Kind of initiated in the sense that we make funds and in some cases legal representation available to groups on the ground who are fighting for recognition of their ancestral lands, fighting against illegal logging or ranchers who are invading their land. So it is very much global, but you can imagine we're limited by resources and what have you. So there tends to be particularly at the moment a focus on the tribes people, indigenous peoples in South America in particular. You may have heard in the news about some uncontacted tribes in the Peruvian Amazon. That was breaking news about 2 weeks ago. Kind of probably caught it on the TV and the internet, and these are people who choose to remain uncontacted because they know from experience what contact with the outside world means, which is usually theft of their land and resources, and exposure to diseases that they don't have any immunity to.
So part of your work today then is to raise awareness of their plight, and part of the work you're doing is to hopefully raise some funds to help you do the work you're doing.
Absolutely. For example, one of the urgent campaigns is to do with the Bushmen of the Kalahari in Botswana, there was a legal case that dragged on for about 5 years. I think in November last year, they actually managed to gain recognition of their right to return to their ancestral lands, and now the campaign it was a successful campaign, but now it's moved into another phase of actually trying to get that judgment enforced and actually recognised by the government. So even though they've won the right to go back, the government's not the Botswana government is not allowing them free movement to go back to their lands.
So where your campaigns have been successful across the world, it sounds like it's been through use of legal representation, effective legal representation.
Absolutely. It really depends on the individual case. I mean, for example, I just mentioned the Botswana the Bushmen of the Kalahari in Botswana. That was very much a developed into a legal case. But quite often, we find that. Publicity, raising people's awareness, and I think it's vastly underestimated, but even letter writing may sound kind of ineffectual, but when a government's getting letters from, say the Brazilian government is getting letters from around the world, from concerned individuals, concerned about, say, a dam project. There's a particular tribe called the Enewene Nawe, who are threatened by a massive a series of dams that could totally wipe out their way of life, which is being funded by money from the World Bank and International Monetary Fund. So there's some.
That's quite heartening to know, because I think for a lot of us, we feel that individual action perhaps is somewhat tame in comparison to the might of the World Bank or to the might of governments or to the rich CEOs of companies. It's heartening to know that individual grassroots action can be effective.
Oh, absolutely, absolutely. And don't forget, I mean, it's people on the ground. I mean, in some cases they're paying for the struggle and the fight, you know, with their lives. I mean, you know, they're facing up to, you know, illegal logging and ranchers who are invading their land, hiring mercenaries, if you like, you know, to counter their legitimate kind of fight for their land and their human rights, and in some cases they're actually paying for it, you know, with their lives. So that's the least we can do, really.
If there's anyone listening now who would like to find out more about your organisation's work, are there any contact numbers or websites that you'd like to give now?
I think the best way of keeping yourself informed is to visit the website, which is www.survival-international.org. In fact, on the homepage, you can sign up for a e-news letter that comes out once a month to keep you abreast of issues and breaking news and stuff.
Well, thank you very much, Tej, for your time.
Thank you. Thank you, man.
Thank you, Tej, from Survival International. Coming up next, our instalment of Cider with Rosie, read by our very own Malcolm Green.
Cider with Rosie, by Laurie Lee. Waking one morning in the whitewashed bedroom, I opened my eyes and found them blind. Though I stretched them and stared where the room should be, nothing was visible but a glare of gold flat on my throbbing eyelids. I groped for my body and found it there. I heard the singing of birds, yet there was nothing at all to be seen of the world save this quivering yellow light. Was I dead, I wondered? Was I in heaven? Whatever it was, I hated it. I had wakened too soon from a dream of crocodiles, and I was not ready for this further outrage. Then I heard the girl's steps on the stairs.
"Our Marge!" I shouted. "I can't see nothing!"
And I began to give out my howl. A slap of bare feet slithered across the floor, and I heard Sister Marjorie's giggle. "Just look at him," she said. "Pop and fetch a flannel, Doff. His eyes have got stuck down again." The cold edge of the flannel passed over my face, showered me with water, and I was back in the world. Bed and beams, and the sun square window, and the girls bending over me, grinning.
"Who did it?"
I yelled. "Nobody, silly. Your eyes got bunged up, that's all." The sweet glue of sleep. It had happened before, but somehow I always forgot. So I threatened the girls I'd bung theirs up, too. I was awake. I could see. I was happy. I lay looking out of a small green window. The world outside was crimson and on fire. I'd never seen it looking like that before.
"Doff," I said, "what's happening to them trees?"
Dorothy was dressing. She leaned out of the window, slow and sleepy, and the light came through her nightdress like sand through a sieve.
"Nothing's happening," she said.
"Yes, it is, then," I said. "They're falling to bits."
Dorothy scratched her dark head, yawning wide, and white feathers floated out of her hair.
"Well, it's only the leaves dropping. We're in autumn now. The leaves always drop in autumn."
Autumn? In autumn? Was that where we were? Where the leaves always dropped and there was always this smell? I imagined it continuing with no change forever, these wet flames of woods burning on and on like the bush of Moses, as natural a part of this newfound land as the eternal snows of the poles. Why had we come to such a place? Marjorie, who had gone down to help with the breakfast, suddenly came tumbling back up the stairs. "Doth," she whispered. She seemed excited and frightened. "Doth, he's turned up again. Help on Lowell with his clothes and come down, quick." We went down and found him sitting by the fireside, smiling, wet and cold. I climbed up to the breakfast table and stared at him, the stranger. To me, he did not so much appear to be a man as a conglomeration of woody things. His face was red and crinkled, brilliant like fungus. There were leaves in his mud-matted hair, and leaves and twigs on his crumbling clothes and all over him. His boots were like the black pulp you find when you dig under a tree. Mother gave him porridge and bread, and he smiled palely at us all. "It must have been cruel in the wood," said our mother. "I've got some sacks, Mum," he said, spooning up his porridge. "They keep out the wet." They wouldn't. They'd suck it up like a wick and wrap him in it. "You oughtn't to live like that," said Mother. "You ought to get back to your home." "No," smiled the man. "That wouldn't do. They'd jump on me before he could say knife." Mother shook her head sadly and sighed and gave him more porridge. We boys adored the look of the man. The girls, fastidious, were more uncertain of him. But he was no tramp, or he wouldn't be in the kitchen. He had 4 bright medals in his pocket, which he would produce and polish and lay on the table like money. He spoke like nobody else we knew. In fact, we couldn't understand many of his words, but Mother seemed to understand him, and would ask him questions, and look at the photographs he carried in his shirt, and sigh and shake her head. He talked something of battles and of flying in the air, and it was all wonderful to us. He was no man from these parts. He had appeared on the doorstep on early morning, asking for a cup of tea. Our mother had brought him in and given him a whole breakfast. There had been blood on his face, and he had seemed very weak. Now he was in a kitchen with a woman and a lot of children, and his eyes shone brightly and his whiskers smiled. He told us he was sleeping in the wood, which seemed to me a good idea. And he was a soldier, because Mother had said so. I knew all about war. All my uncles were in it. My ears from birth had been full of the talk of it. Sometimes I used to climb into the basket chair by the fire and close my eyes and see brown men moving over a field in battle. I was 3, but I saw them grope and die, and felt myself older than they. This man did not look like a soldier. He was not brassoed, leather-belted and wax-whiskered like my uncles. He had a beard, and his khaki was torn. But the girls insisted he was a soldier, and said it in whispers, like a secret. And when he came down to our house for breakfast, and sat hunched by the fire, steaming with damp and coated with leaves and dirt, I thought of him sleeping up there in the wood. I imagined him sleeping, then having a go at a battle, then coming down to us for a cup of tea. He was the war, and the war was up there. I wanted to ask, "How's the war in the wood?" But he never told us. He sat drinking his tea, gulping and gasping, the fire drawing the damp out of his clothes as if ghosts were rising from him. When he caught our eyes, he smiled from his beard. And when Brother Jack shot at him with a spoon, saying, "I'm a soldier," he replied softly,
Aye. And he'd make a better one than me, son, any day. When he said that, I wondered what had happened to the war. Was he in those rags because he was such a bad soldier? Had he lost the war in the wood? When he didn't come any more, I knew he had. The girls said some policemen had taken him away in a cart. My mother sighed and was sad over the poor man.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
And now here is Tony Gosling with his fourth part of The History of Theatre in Bristol. The story of the Bristol stage from 1490 to 1925, serialised in 9 parts from the book of the same name by Miss M. Board. Part 4, the opening of the Old Vic on King Street. On May the 30th, 1766, the theatre was opened under the management of Powell, Holland and Clark. There was a ground rent of £22. Garrick was present in the audience, and he also wrote a prologue, an epilogue, especially for the occasion. The play was Steele's Conscious Lovers, and was followed by The Citizen, a farce. If this should prove a windmill scheme, alas, I know, and I will tell you what will pass. We all, each son of Thespis, and each daughter, must for sweet Bristol milk drink Bristol water. The play was billed as a concert of music and a specimen of rhetoric, and was given as a charity performance for the infirmary, £63 profit being handed over afterwards to that institution. This strange proceeding was an attempt to elude the law, as the theatre was not yet licensed. The Puritan influence had not been strong enough to prevent the theatre's erection, but it prevailed in holding back the licence. Foote, at the Haymarket, also suffering from Puritan restraint, invited his audience to tea, and an auction of pictures and many other subterfuges were restored in the evasion of law. This serious civic opposition continued for 7 years, and it was only terminated in 1777. 1769 was a most tragic year for the old theatre. William Powell, the senior lessee, died, and later in the year Holland died of smallpox. So passed two of three lessees of this theatre. Mr. Hippisley had planned a theatre for Bath, and his dream matured under the good offices of a Mr. Palmer, a Bath brewer. Palmer's son came to Bristol and took over management. Mr. Dornby, nominee of the proprietors, was granted a royal patent in 1777 for our theatre, which has, since that date, held the name of Theatre Royal and the Old Vic. Mr. Palmer held a lease for 20 years at the rental of £200. Mr. Palmer managed both the theatres in Bath and Bristol, and they both prospered under his management. They had 3 evening performances a week, the company travelling by road, and their strange appearance was a source of delight to the public. During Lent, Palmer had oratorios in the Bristol Theatre. Mrs. Siddons, that great and good woman, came to Bristol in 1779. She had been a member of Palmer's Bath Company. She was very sore at heart, as she had proved a failure at Drury Lane. She attributed this to Garrick's jealousy. In reality, he was all patience and consideration, and her failure was entirely caused by her immaturity. She was the daughter of Kemble, the actor, and she was only 20. Here in Bristol she learnt so much of the art that on her return to London she took the town by storm. It's interesting to know that her salary in Bristol was £3 a week. Bristol served as a school to some of the great artists of the stage. The memory of this old stock company is her glory. What a history it is. Mrs. Siddons finally left Bristol and returned to town in 1812, and the same year the beautiful old assembly rooms in Prince Street was altered and redecorated and opened as the Regency Theatre. The performances consisted chiefly of pantomimes and burletta. It does not seem worthy of that lovely place, and the venture soon failed. In 1813, the Regency Theatre was suppressed by the civic authorities on the pretext of it being unlicensed. No doubt the real cause was not far to seek. Bad times came for the sister theatres. In 1817, the lease of the Theatre Royal Bristol was acquired by Mr. Bowles Watson, who already had theatres in Gloucester and Cheltenham. Bath did not interest him. It was not good for our theatre, for his heart was not with us, and we are thankful to pass to March the 29th, 1819, when the lease fell in to one of Bristol's most famous managers, William Macready. Macready was a good actor and essentially a good man.
His son, William Charles Macready, the world-famous tragedian, came from Covent Garden and brought with him Mr. Charles Williams and Mrs. Yates to give his father's management a good send-off with Othello as the trump card. They played for 3 nights. There was still much opposition to the theatre in Bristol, and Macready knew his father needed his help. On March the 2nd, 1819, Mr. Terry came from the Theatre Royal Covent Garden to play in Bristol. William Charles Macready came often to help his father. He'd recommended a Miss Atkins, and she had become a member of the Bristol Company. The younger Macready took a great interest in her artistic education, so imperceptibly began one of our famous theatrical romances. It's charming to read Macready's own words about his courting. Miss Atkins became the devoted wife of the famous actor. In the course of the past 2 seasons, I had made several excursions to my father's theatre in Bristol, when crowded houses almost invariably welcomed me. These visits brought more particularly under my notice the young actress Miss Atkins, who had so won my interest. In her unaffected pathos and sprightliness, I had seen the germ of a very rare talent, and was anxious its development should not be marred by any premature attempt. Love approached under friendship's name, although unsuspected and unconfessed by either of us. Mr. Macready greatly improved and enlarged the theatre, and he introduced coal gas instead of oil lamps. Macready was a good man and universally respected. It's such as he and Mrs. Siddons who justify the honourable profession of art and show what the stage can be in the hands of saintly men. Macready was a man of ingenuity. He required a waterfall in the middle of the cataract of the Ganges, so he introduced a real water from an invisible source. This was from the fire engines of the Sun and Norwich Union insurance offices. Macready produced a most spectacular play, into which he introduced the crowds who witnessed the coronation of George IV. The procession crossed the stage, and afterwards the scene of the coronation in the Abbey was presented. Macready was not only a good actor, he was also a good playwriter. The best-known plays from his pen are The Bank Note, The Village Lawyer, and The Irishman in Naples. There was much love between Macready and his public, and it was a great loss to Bristol when he died. He was buried on April the 18th, 1829, in Bristol Cathedral. A benefit was given for Mrs. Macready and her children. William Charles Macready became the following week an Inverquins and William Tell, and again May the 22nd in Damon and Pythias, after which performance the house closed. On August the 31st, the theatre was reopened under the management of Mr. Richard Brunston. He had an excellent company, and Mrs. Macready was his leading lady. Unhappily, however, his brief tenure was a failure. The next manager was Mr. Bellamy, son of the famous actor. This management also terminated unsuccessfully in 1833. Mrs. Macready was urged to take the management at that point. She was a most remarkable woman, and that cannot be doubted. Before her marriage, she had made a fine name for herself, as Miss Matt Desmond was her maiden name, in the north of England. There she was famous as Meg Merrilees in Guy Mannering, Helen MacGregor in Rob Roy, and Elizabeth in Kenilworth. Mrs. Macready opened her first season on February the 3rd, 1834, with Speed the Plough and The Haunted Inn. Great energy distinguished her regime, and she had some remarkable productions. She was determined in her management that it should be a financial success, and she was most resourceful. She produced The Jewess. In the principal scene of this play, when the Emperor Sigismund makes his entry, 200 people were on the stage. She also procured Durow's famous circus, and at another time, some Bedouin Arabs. This proved a great attraction. She gave a series of promenade concerts and even a fancy dress ball. Mrs. Macready still acted when the occasion arose. James Henry Chute joined the company in 1842. During the same year, Bristol was visited by Mr. and Mrs. Charles Kean and Miss Fanny Kemble, Mr. Wolds, and many other famous artists. Mrs. Macready opened her season in September as lessee of both Bath and Bristol theatres in 1845, Bath having suffered from a succession of failures in management. Mrs. Macready lived in Bath. James Henry Chute became lessee of the Bath Assembly Rooms, which he held until 1858. Here was born on July the 10th, 1856, his son, James Macready Chute, a future beloved Bristol manager. The year 1851 marked the last appearance of William Charles Macready on the boards of the Bristol stage. This great period of our theatrical history was attained a worldwide notoriety, and well it may, for the Bristol stage had seen most of our famous actors, and the Bristol Stock Company is a magnificent memory. Mr. Shute made a runaway match with Miss MacReady, MacReady's sister. Mrs. MacReady was very angry, but afterwards forgave them, and they went to live with her in Bath. Mr. Shute was her manager in Bristol. In 1852, Mrs. MacReady produced Uncle Tom's Cabin, which her husband had dramatised and for which Mr. Salmon wrote the music. It was one of her most famous productions. On March the 9th, 1853, this famous and most courageous woman died at Bath. Her last appearance on the stage was as Miami in Green Bushes. James Henry Shute took over the management of both theatres. He was known on the stage as Mr. Chu. On Monday, September the 12th, Mr. Shute opened the Theatre Royal with The Wife, A Tale of Mantua by Sheridan Knowles. During the interval, whilst the theatre was closed, Mr. Shute had been very busy. It had been redecorated, painted, papered, ornamented, and gilded. He had provided a new drop act. The stage had been extended, the company's water being laid on and fire mains provided, and the theatre had been properly ventilated. The band, which consisted of 10 musicians, was conducted by Mr. Salmon, and Mr. Cooper was the leader. The scenery was painted by Messrs. Lennox, Gilbert and Thorne. The stage decorations and properties were by Mr. Woodyer of the Theatre Royal Dublin. James Henry Shute revived Uncle Tom's Cabin, with George Melville and John Volaire in the cast. He also produced It's Never Too Late to Mend. Mr. Cooper left and went to Covent Garden, and Mr. Thaddeus Wells took his place as leader of the band. Uncle Tom was a phenomenal success, and was about 30 years on and off before the public. The pantomime of 1853 was The World of Flowers. In 1854 it was Gulliver's Travels. In 1855, Miss Fanny Bennett made an excellent Hamlet. Madame Cheslett was a frequent visitor. There were continued visits from Italian, Dublin and English opera companies. In 1856, Jack and the Beanstalk was the pantomime. 1857, it was Valentine and Orson. The stock company of this time is worth consideration, and for interest, some of their salaries are inserted. Madge Robertson, 1 shilling and 6 pence a night. Fred Robertson, Fred Marshall, Kate Bishop, Alfred Bishop, who was recorded as having on one occasion received 6 pence for a night, and King and Bishop, who were children. It was a magnificent education, but what fine material was there. Mr. Salmon generally took the leader of the band, with 3 other instrumentalists with him, to Bath. That was part 4 of The Story of the Bristol Stage by Miss M. Board. Next week, part 5, Prince's Theatre on Park Row. The Avon Association of Drama covers Bath and North East Somerset, Bristol, North Somerset and South Gloucestershire areas, and publishes Prompt magazine 10 times a year. Other activities include festivals, playwriting, open air and touring productions, publicity and training. Individual membership and subscription to Prompt is £10 a year, and the Avon Association of Drama's website is at avondrama.co.uk. Mark Graves is their subscription secretary on 01454 238 384.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk.
Thank you very much to Tony Gosling, and now here's Lisa Braden with her report from the play American Clock.
We're in the money. It takes to get along.
Now we know that
we're in the money. The skies are sunny.
Oh,
oh man, depression, you are through. You've done us wrong.
We never see a headline but a bread line today. And when we see the landlord,
we can look that guy right in the eye.
Oh,
we're in the money. Come on, my honey. Let's spend it, lend it, send it rolling along.
I'm Lisa Braden from Dialect Radio, and I'm with 4 strapping lads from the American Clock, which is on at the Redgrave Theatre in Percival Road. Were you aware when you were planning this play of the impending credit crunch, or was it just that it just so happened that way?
We knew.
Yeah, I think it was something that it made the play more special because of how topical it was going to be. But one of the main reasons they chose it was because it's a large ensemble show, and it's something, as our graduating show, we can all show off as in different areas of performance.
Do you think that people will feel uncomfortable watching it, or do you think they'll feel a certain empathy because of the current economic climate?
I think probably both, to be honest. There's a certain degree of fear that we've all felt as cast members looking at the news, considering that we're surrounded by this whole atmosphere all day, every day in rehearsals of a play like this.
So you're all graduates, so any plans, anyone snapped you up, any offers?
Well, there's industry professionals hopefully coming to see this show, so agents, cast and directors, hopefully work and representation will come from there. I mean, yeah, Bash has already got representation.
Yeah, a few of us have got already from the showcase, and others of us have interest where people are going to come and see us in this, so it better be good.
Yeah.
So how do you feel particularly about Bristol, so as regards the Old Vic, because it's not open at the moment? Does that sadden you? Or?
I think having... Normally the graduate show is done down at the theatre,
yeah, sure.
And that would have been nice for us to have done.
It is a really sad thing to miss out on, not being at the Old Vic, being at the Old Vic School.
But knowing it's being refurbished and it's looking a lot more hopeful in the future, so hopefully it'll just be a brilliant theatre when it reopens.
As a producing house, hopefully. That's what we want.
Yes.
So how do you feel about sort of similarities between sort of Northern Rock and Mortgage Repossessions? It's very relevant with the play, isn't it? Especially, you know, with the mother.
We've used that, we've drawn on that, and we did a lot of research into that to help feed, our experience of the show. But no doubt the audience will have that on their minds when they watch it. It just shows that history is cyclical, and these things never go away.
That's the thing that hit me.
I think the other thing is it shows that the person at the top is usually the one that suffers. So in Hoover's case during the Depression, Hoover fell, and it's looking like Gordon Brown is in, you know, economics affects politics
and politics. And there's a lot of Marxism in the show. I mean, a lot of people don't appreciate that Marx was not really writing for Russia. He was writing with America in mind to a large extent as an industrialized society. And it shows in this play how close they came to going that way.
The reminiscent scene for me was a bit like on the waterfront when they're signing up for work.
Well, you see the photos of them just lined up, and it's quite horrific.
And just the figures of 12 tobacco executives earning more than 30,000 people who raise it.
And the awful thing is a lot of the businessmen are the ones who don't really suffer, they survive.
No, I mean, I can't remember, but how much did the guy who ran Northern Rock get paid? He got a big payoff.
Mm.
Big, yeah.
Good luck with your career, and I hope it all works out wonderfully for all of you.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, Lisa, and thank you for listening, because that's about all we've got time for this week. If you would like to get involved in running the show, feel free to contact us through our website, dialectradio.net. We are especially eager to offer training opportunities to any budding studio engineers out there. Production this week was by Matt Heap. Our presenter was me, John Peters Coleman. Reports were by Anthea Page, Lisa Braden and Matt Heap. Tony Gosling read the news and the piece about the theatre. And Sidey with Rosie was read by Malcolm Grieve. And our studio engineer was Velis Chipchukuran. Dialect Radio would like to thank its sponsors, The Converging World. Check out theconvergingworld.org. We hope you enjoyed listening, and tune in next week. Have fun.